stretch out, that your skin can bring you so much pain. Now I hear you say, you got the best of both ways. Won't you come and take a walk in my shoes, and tell me if you take my place.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Shoe Geeks podcast, Inside Running. And this morning, I've got Julian with me, who owns the running company at Ballarat.
Hello.
Good morning. How you going, mate?
Sounds like an early morning for you.
It is an early morning for me, so just to talk to you boys. And all the way from Sydney, we have Thomas DeCanto, owner of Walker Street Podiatry. And both boys, 2:14 marathon runners, so one doing more training than the other at the moment. How you been going, Tommy?
Hey, mate. Good. Good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very good. How's your month of training been? Been pretty good?
Yeah, I can't complain. I've been stringing together some good training lately, so the last month has been more of the same. I had a bit of a down week last week leading into the state cross-country champs.
Yeah, I saw that. You ran well there.
I was happy enough.
You were happy? Yeah, good.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I would have preferred not to fade out and die in the last 2K, but it was okay.
That's normally preferable.
Yeah.
The course looked good, and the competition looked pretty good there as well. So do you want to walk us through what happened?
Yeah, sure. It was a fun event. It was well supported and well organized. And it's a really nice, it's a purpose built course down in Dapto. The Kembla joggers have this sort of just a clubhouse there.
It was the Kemblers course, was it? The one they had the national cross.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So
it's a fantastic course, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good. It's a good course. It's not hilly. Like, it's not challenging. I think the Nowra course, which it was originally planned to be at, would have been preferable. I just think it's good to have some hills to really challenge and split packs and make it tough. But it's tough enough with all the bends, and there's some pretty hard bends in it. It was windy and it was warm, so it made it pretty challenging.
What shoes did you wear for this one?
Dragonflies. There was a lot of dragonflies out there.
It's the norm now, isn't it?
Yeah.
How were they stability-wise and grip? Because there's a plastic plate up the front still, isn't there?
Yeah, so grip was great. Like, you just dig in with the spikes around the turns. I reckon stability was a bit of an issue. Like, I ran the short course in the Victory spikes, which is a little bit lower to the ground, and pulled up pretty fine from that. But I guess the combination of the distance, so 10K instead of 5, plus the softer foam around those bends, like, my feet, they only just sort of recovered yesterday. Like, I've had some foot DOMs, and they've been pretty sore, and like perineals pretty sore. So I don't know. Maybe just a bit of a compromise, like having that nice cush, but then on the bends, on those tight bends, it might just I don't know if anyone listening to the pod has seen those pics of Cheptegei floating around, but you're gonna with high stacked shoes around bends, running at pace, you might sort of increase movement around the ankle, and so some muscles and tendons might get a little bit more loaded with the spike like that.
Mate, I think every second physio has flaunted that photo and given orthotics the flick, saying that no, if your foot everts like this, it's 100% normal. If Cheptegei can do it, so it's been everywhere, that picture.
Yeah,
it has. It's got a real lot of coverage. And so, what, Nita? You went through, like, I know you, it triggered you a bit, didn't it?
I mean, we see this at the track all the time, even in normal spikes. You know, running counterclockwise, the left foot going around, and the foot everts a lot. I guess because the shoe's a bit higher stack foam. I mean, he's running 63 second laps consistently through there, and what his foot's doing and what the shoe's doing is not the same thing. This is what people need to realize. His foot's probably more perpendicular. It's just, it looks a hell of a lot worse than what it is. And I mean, he's been doing this his whole life, so there's probably not much risk attached to his foot everting, but it doesn't make it, you know, 100% regular for people to be out. Like, you don't see that as often on a weekly day at the track, for example. Like, you normally need the planets to align, hit the right part of the shoe. And I'm sure it wasn't every single step either. So, but there's another footage of him front on, and it shows just the natural differences between the left and right side of his feet. But as soon as you add a high stack foam, you create a higher moment arm across the subtalar joint. So if you evert, you just evert harder, don't you? So, and you add compliant foam, you sort of almost fall out the upper of the shoe. So I think people are really making it a bit over-dramatized, but I think my foot does that pretty aggressively. And, you know, remember the first iteration of the 4% but in the Flyknit upper?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because the Flyknit upper was so compliant. Like, it's very rare to see someone hit the ground and look really perpendicular in that shoe when you're going around the bend. So,
yeah.
But you don't see it in a pro as much, I don't think. The foams, the Saucony Dauphin Pro, because, you know, the midsole is a bit firmer, less compliant. Still very high stack, but you just don't see it aggressively falling out the side of the shoe. So,
yeah. You remember watching Gebre Selassie run road races in the Adios, and it looked it looked similar to that as well, actually.
Yeah. It did, yeah.
Yeah. And then there was people talking about, oh, this must be good for you.
Yeah.
Someone's running the world record. Maybe we all want to look like this.
So they'll start building shoes that are poor and everted probably now, just aesthetically to accommodate people's desire to run like Chip the Guy.
Like, hey, maybe that's your answer, Nita, to the lateral flare on the New Balance shoes.
Very true. Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding out more about that.
Good question. Wasn't there a shoe, the ASICS Ballarat, that was actually a walking shoe that encouraged the foot to pronate?
Yeah, that was for medial knee, OA.
Yeah.
So they basically put a little, I don't know if it was a lateral wedge or just higher durometer on the outsole of the like the lateral part of the shoe.
Yeah.
The whole idea was to evert your foot to try and offload the medial aspect of the knee. And I'm not sure the shoe sold very well, but
so niche.
Medial knee LA is relatively niche, I suppose, if you're looking for a shoe that may not work for it either. So.
And that came off the back of one study, right?
Or
was it a few studies culminating?
There's a couple of studies that have looked at like putting a wedge under the lateral part of your foot and its effect on the medial knee. And I think, I mean, you might have to correct me if I'm wrong here because I haven't looked into this too much, Tom. But, you know, if you have mild medial knee OA, it seems to have some sort of effect. But if you have moderate to severe medial knee OA, it seems to have no effect regardless. So. Mm.
Yeah, it's to do with the alignment of the knee. I think if you've already got like quite significant bow legs associated with that medial knee pain, then the shoe or orthotic wedging is not as effective as someone that has pretty like normal knee alignment but has the pain.
Yep.
And I think the clinical trials weren't that impressive, but it was always based. I think it was based off like just biomechanical model. So they were modeling.
That's right.
Yeah, in theory, this will be great. But then in reality, I don't think it was as effective as they thought it would be.
No, that's right. But we see a lot of shoes now with like that lateral flaring into the actual shoe as well. I'd be interested to see if just the lateral flare becomes, you know, as useful as, you know, as a lateral wedge or a, you know, higher durometer lateral foam as well. But anyway, we're not here to talk about, you know, medial knee OA. I don't think so. Although there's probably a lot of people that have medial knee OA. I'm sure that'll be the next listener question that pops in next week.
If people
don't
know what OA is, it's osteoarthritis, by the way.
Yeah, and you can't buy that ASICS Ballarat anymore. It's done. I'm sure they don't have that anymore. They probably sold four pairs, and whoever thought it was a good idea bringing that into the market probably lost their job. Tom, what shoes did you train in this month? Anything different to last month?
To be honest, I know we chatted about the Kayano Light a bit last month, but I've been doing a fair bit in that shoe just to give it a good run in. And I'm enjoying it. Like I think it's a pretty nice model, particularly for just the easy runs post session days. Particularly, it's nice just to feel a little bit more protected on those days.
Does it still feel as good as it's getting a bit more volume into it now as well?
Yeah, still feels pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
The durability is okay so far.
Good.
And using the 880 still a little bit. So New Balance 880, which I kind of wasn't using in the rotation for a few weeks, and I brought it back in, and just enjoying it. Still,
that was your Achilles shoe, wasn't it? Your fat man shoe for a period of time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, coming out of my crumbly Achilles, and it's a good shoe. It's boring. It's just nothing special, but it's just comfortable, secure. Like the upper, just I got a bit tired of some of these shoes with not great lockdown, like the knitted uppers and stuff like that, and the unstructured heel counters. And so it's kind of nice to get back into like a bit more of a traditional, like getting good lockdown and just cushion and just normal geometry rather than like big rockers and so that's probably it. Just those couple of shoes. I've kind of blown out my shoe budget last month, so this month I've been a bit like I've been wanting to get some shoes, but I've had nothing new to the rotation.
What are you looking at getting, you reckon, potentially?
I want to get some race. I just want to get, like, I'd love to get the RC Elite. I want to check that out. From a training perspective, I've got plenty on the go at the moment, like still using the Nova Blast and that Reebok shoe that you love so much, Julian.
I haven't seen it yet. Anyway.
My goal is to get you in a pair of Reeboks one day.
Yeah, I still don't know how you can buy them in Australia.
Just the Aussie website. That's it. That's the only place that that you can. I don't know any retailers that actually stock it.
No.
You can see their CrossFit shoe elsewhere, but you can't see it. Oh, yeah.
True. There is that's where their game is right now.
It is. Yeah. What about you, Julian? What have you been wearing? You're back into running almost 60Ks a week. So tell us about your shoe rotation right now.
Yeah. So last time I left you with the question, what shoe should I wear? I need sort of a low drop, high cushion, rigid shoe. Mm-hmm. And you said New Balance More, and that was pretty good, I thought, Tom. But I found an even better option. The Ultra Olympus. So
walk us through the Ultra, the concept.
I don't know about this one.
Yeah, well, the Ultra is a brand from the US, started by a couple of guys that worked in a shoe store that found themselves cutting shoes down and altering shoes that they had in stock for customers. They've got sort of three main concepts. Two main concepts. One is that they're zero drop, so none of their shoes have any heel pitch in them. And the second concept is they've got like these anatomical toe boxes, which are shaped like a foot. So they're sort of narrower and through the heel and then through the midfoot they broaden, and then through the toe box it looks like a bit of a paddle, like they're very broad up front. Kind of if you look down on your foot, how it's shaped. And they're pretty roomy, but I really enjoy having a broader shoe or a shoe with a lot, like a wider toe box. And the model from those guys that's most popular in the world is the Lone Peak.
Yeah.
So that's a trail shoe, and that's the most sold trail shoe in the US in run specialty stores. So
yeah, wow.
Ultra in the US is quite phenomenal how big it is, especially in the trail world. And we sort of see that over here too, that the biggest model that we deal with is the Lone Peak in store.
It's still high stack, isn't it, these shoes, with the one that you have?
I think Lone Peak's like 28 mil, but it doesn't feel like that. It feels, no, maybe it's less than that. It feels less to me, the Lone Peak. It's very good on technical terrain. Mm-hmm. It's really durable. It's very sticky, the outer sole. These are high quality products now. At the start, like when you get a lot of these smaller brands, they kind of make shoes on shoestring budgets, and the uppers are a bit poxy, and you sort of see a few issues with them. But now these guys are sort of making shoes that the quality is like as good as the major brands. And the Ultra Olympus that I have is their maximal trail shoe.
So I'm looking at it now. It's a beast.
Yeah, the 4.0. The 4.0 is the new version. It's got a Vibram outer sole. It's pretty sticky. It is a beast. It's got massive footprint.
What's it weigh? Does it weigh over 400?
Oh, it's
still
heavy. 330.
I don't care what it weighs. It doesn't matter. It's not a racing shoe.
Mate, you'd be worried if you were a size 13 like me. You'd be worried about it.
Yeah, well,
You wouldn't enjoy it. You wouldn't be enjoying it as much.
But you're a bigger unit. How much do you weigh?
70.
70, yeah. You're a kilo. Well,
tell us why you've chosen this shoe, because it's got no heel pitch. Like I've put on one, I think it might be the Ultra Escalante. Is it? Yeah. Is that? A, yeah. And it was like, it's a lower profile shoe. And I remember the first thing when I put that shoe on, I'm like, oh, this thing needs heel raise. Yeah. And so I find that tough to run in. But obviously, you're finding it fine to run it with no heel pitch issues. And how's that treat your planter? Okay, because it's obviously quite low pitch, but obviously nice and stiff, I'm assuming.
It's very different to the Escalante. So within their range, you would say they have a minimal shoe called like the Escalante, or there's another one called the Superior. They're what I would call minimal shoes. And then as we get up to the Torrent, and the Torrent is their road version. They've got one called a Paradigm. And so although they have zero drop, the shoes are massively rigid. They're very stable because of a really wide footprint. And the Olympus is like that. So the rigidity of the shoe and the broad nature, especially through the rear foot, means that I can, if I want to, I can land through the rear of the shoe with no sort of consequence. Some of their shoes are so narrow, like through the back, and so soft that if you land through the rear foot, you basically fall off the shoe immediately. And they're the ones that are very unforgiving. And that's when, like, I've run in those before, and my calves get really sore and tight. And I'm sure that they wouldn't be great for me because I'm forced into a more 4 foot strike.
Got it.
Yeah. Maybe the Escalante, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Escalante for sure. But yeah, this Olympus, I can land through the rear foot with, and I don't. It doesn't even feel like zero drop. It actually feels like the Hoka Stinson, but it does feel more dynamic, and it feels like a nicer running shoe.
Nice.
So yeah, I've been in that shoe, and it does fit the device that I've been using. So I've got like this little EVA insole. So I guess that. That my podiatrist Luke Madley's made for me. He's made two of them to fit different shaped shoes. So I've been using the 880 I got in the 2E width, because that, like, I took my insole into the store. I tried basically every shoe in the store to feel what felt most comfortable, and that was the shoe that felt most comfortable.
And 880 with the device is pretty forgiving. Like, it tends to work for a lot of devices. Do you feel, like, obviously, how do you feel with the device going into the Olympus? So having no heel pitch, like most shoes have about an 8 to 10 mil heel pitch. As soon as you drop the heel pitch down, for example, you normally feel the orthotic a bit more.
Yeah, I do feel it. But I don't, because it's so broad and it's quite deep as a shoe, there's a fair bit of volume there. So I don't get as much pressure as I do when I put it in. Like the Kayano Light that I've been using, which I feel like, because the orthotic's almost like jammed in the shoe more, it takes up more volume, and so I have less volume for my feet. So this is a thing we see really often with really high volume devices, very wedged, very thick through the midfoot. They don't fit in a lot of shoes.
Well, it's a good point to bring that up. Like, obviously, you know, you're well versed in this as well, Tommy, but you got like two sort of designs of orthoses where, with, you know, you've got shank dependent ones, which are, you know, that's built out of EVA or a material that essentially is filled in, so like a foam, and so that needs to match the last of the shoe a little bit better. Otherwise, the last of the shoe and the shape of the shoe, the volume of the shoe, can really change the you know, where the orthotic puts pressure on the base of your foot, whereas the non-shank dependent orthotics are the ones that you tend to see that have, they're just built out of like a plastic type material, nylon, or built out of carbon fiber. And they actually tend to, you know, they jump over the middle of your shoe a little bit more, and sometimes they're not as influenced by the geometry, and they can flex a lot more as well over those geometry points. So sometimes the shank orthotics and non-shank ones can be really influenced by different shoes. So that makes it tough for the retailer as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. So like you're saying, Julian, the best thing to do with those is try them in a number of shoes to see, you know, which ones they actually suit well and sit well in.
Yeah. So the cues we use in store are like, if someone has an orthotic, then we sort of say, oh, which, like, if we get to the end, it's like, which shoe do you feel your orthotic less in? Normally a good way of deciding.
That's a very good way.
Yeah. And so I've actually been struggling a little in terms of how much I should feel my orthotic, because I have sensitivity in my plantar fascia because of the plantar fasciitis I have. I'm sometimes torn between wanting to be comfortable in the shoe without pressure, but also requiring that support element that the orthotic offers. And so it's been really difficult for me to work with the podiatrist as to how aggressive we go with the orthotic. And it's really hard to articulate what level of sort of how pronounced the feel is in your arch. It's really difficult to sort of tell someone, oh yeah, I can feel it. Is it a bad feel or a good feel? You're like, I don't know, I just feel it. So it's a really difficult thing. How do you work with your patients to work out how strong to make the device?
I think, you go with this first, Tom, if you want, but I've got a bit of an answer for that. It's tricky. I think a lot of the times you've got to pick the patient as well. Like a lot of the times if someone's going to remove an orthosis because they feel pressure, and that does happen with people, a lot of the time you want to make sure that if you're building it to offload a stress or a tissue, like a plantar heel pain, for example, you're still trying to meet halfway. But often I'll try simple things like if they feel the longitudinal arch a little bit too much, I can place mild little heel raises into the base of the shoe beneath it for 1, 2, 3 mils until they don't feel the longitudinal arch as much. Other options will be, we'll just, see what it's like sitting in the shoe geometry-wise. But in terms of getting used to it, it's a bit like shoes now as well. Like while it may feel a bit foreign, it shouldn't feel super foreign. I call it like the goofy scale. Like if someone feels like 3 out of 10 on the goofy scale, they'll probably be used to it within a week. But if it feels 5, 6, or 7 out of 10, I know that's quite subjective. They're probably not going to get used to it, and you need to modify it or at least change the shoe that's going into. So you get a pretty good perception from the get-go if someone's going to walk out not enjoying that orthosis, and that person probably needs some modification, to be honest. So you pretty much get onto that straight away.
Yeah, that's very similar to how Luke thinks. I think you guys would get along.
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the beauties. There's pros and cons for shank and non-shank dependent orthotics, which, the foam versus the plastics. But the good thing about the foam ones, the shank dependent ones, is you can, and like what you're doing, I think, Julian, like going back and forth with your pod is they'll be adjusted. They can be adjusted quite easily. So it's actually a lot harder to adjust the non-shank dependent, those carbon fiber type ones. Whereas these foam ones, if I have someone that's coming in acute pain, I almost want to over-engineer it for a period of time. So I actually would say, well, to get pain down, maybe we do actually want to be pushing in other areas away from the pain a little bit more, just for say the next 3 weeks, and then I'll see you in 2 or 3 weeks. We'll see how you're going, and maybe I'll actually then reduce that correction over time. So then most people, they're going to wean out of that thing eventually anyway. It's not going to be a long term strategy. We'll just be using that device for a certain period of time while they're getting over their injury. And so the goal would obviously be to reduce correction, so it's a much more just in general comfortable and not noticeable device when we can, when that injury is able to handle those loads and the pressure. That's probably how I'd take it. And if someone's going to be using an orthotic as a long-term strategy, there's still some people that they just seem to feel like happier using a device ongoing for a certain percentage of their volume, then it needs to be comfortable. It needs to work with them. It should be pretty subtle and not something that you're like, cool, yeah, I've got my orthotic in, I can really feel it. It should be way more subtle than that. It should be something that they prefer in than out. That means that it's working with them, not fighting against them. So they actually prefer it in. And it feels subjectively just feels comfy, really comfy when they've got that in there.
Yeah, it's well put. Well put, Tommy.
Yeah. What about you, Nitta? What have you been wearing?
Well, actually, it's funny you say that. Like, I've gone back onto the track to do some more sessions recently as well, and I've been wearing the spikes a bit more, but I'm getting that nice, post-session track calf soreness the day after. And so I've been using the Glide Ride again the day after those track sessions, but, really offloading my calves. So I'll put the Glide Ride on. People who don't know the Glide Ride, I'd say it's probably the most rocking shoe on the market, you reckon?
It's pretty strong.
Yes, I've been putting that on with a 4 mil heel raise because it only has a 5 mil heel pitch with a form phonic, so just like the shelf one. And I tell you what, your calves, you cannot offload your calves.
Your foot's on a holiday.
It is. It really is. Yeah. So I've been back doing that, and that's helped a lot actually. So, but in terms of all the jogging shoes that I've worn, I've given the Dynablast, the Asics Dynablast, maybe 2 months ago. And so I've gone back for that for a couple of jogs now, just for like easier runs between 30 to 45 minutes. Now, it's a bit like the Nova Blast. I don't know if you've worn it, Tommy, or at all, Julian. But
I haven't worn it.
It's just a slightly higher durometer foam.
I haven't.
Yeah, so it's a bit less stack and a little bit higher dense foam. I have enjoyed it on the trails a bit more, but I haven't sort of worn. The upper is really nice. It's like a completely knitted upper, and they've nailed the upper there, but the midsole probably is still a bit firm for me. But I've still been wearing on trails. It feels quite forgiving. So I think ASICS are using this sort of Nova Blast template. Dyna Blast is a second iteration. Maybe if you've got a higher body mass, you might enjoy that shoe a bit more just because the midsole is a bit firmer perhaps. So that's another option for people out there. But ASICS have got such a large selection of shoes now as well. And I don't know, obviously you guys did the London Marathon, saw the London Marathon the other week, and you saw that obviously there was the Meta Racer there. I've given my Meta Racer away to a friend, and he's going to wear them for the 10K track next week. And he loves them. So it works. Obviously, they sit just under that 25mm criteria for World Athletics. And so I think that'll be one of the most popular shoes worn for the 10K track. So if there was a 10K track race tomorrow, I know, Tommy, you've got one coming up in a few weeks' time. What are you going to wear?
I think ours is same weekend as yours. I think it's next week. The state 10. I won't be doing it, but I would wear the Dragonflies. I've had a couple of people ask me because they're kind of worried about wearing spikes and even using the Dragonfly compared to what they're used to, which probably is the Vaporfly. But I reckon the Dragonfly is surprisingly forgiving for a spike, so I think a lot of people with a little bit of practice will be able to get away with using the Dragonfly or something like the Meta Racer.
The problem is the Dragonfly is pretty much unavailable for purchase. And so a lot of it's okay to go and name shoes that are legal on the track, but if you can't actually find them or they're discontinued or Australia doesn't stock them or buy them into the country, then that's where the problem is. So you can say, oh, the Meta Racer, yeah, it's great for the track. Well, can't buy it right now. It's out of stock pretty much everywhere. New Balance, they didn't bring in the 1500 or the 1400 this season. Saucony didn't do the Type A or the Fast Switch. Nike's Streak LT didn't come in the country. Hopefully it comes in later this season. The Streak 7 is 26mm apparently, so can't get away with that on the track. Who else? ASICS does have the Tarthazeel, which I think came in the country. So that's an option if you can find one. Mizuno have a shoe called the Jewel, or the I think it's called the Sonic Jewel or something. So, but then the question is, do you want to spend your money on a shoe that you're probably not going to enjoy that much?
And wear once a year.
And these shoes, they're not crazy expensive, but you might pay $200 for them. Do you wear a shoe like the Next Percent? And according to the rules of the track, you might be able to wear it. You just might get a bit of an asterisk next to your name.
That's right. I'll probably wear the Next Percent, to be completely honest.
We're not paying that then.
Sure. Well, mate, in South Australia, there seems to be that no one's making any rules until December 1. You just go ahead and wear it, and then after that, I'll probably just retire for the 10K.
So are you gonna claim a PB if you run a PB in those?
Yeah, well, if I PB, I'll definitely claim the PB because the last one I ran was in the 4%. So,
but the 4% were legal at that time.
I know they were. So I'll definitely wear something high stack though. But tomorrow I'm going to run a 1500. I'm definitely going to wear the Dragonfly. So I haven't actually raced in the Dragonfly yet. So I'm excited to wear that. Apparently it's worth about a second per lap. So
what's your goal? What's your time?
I don't know. It depends who races, to be honest. Like you won't probably see me working too hard early, but I don't know, I'll run somewhere about 4 minutes if the race goes that way, I think. So if it goes well, it'll go under. If it doesn't go well, it'll be over. So
what's your PB?
356.
Oh, I have the fastest 1500 PB.
Oh, jeez.
Do you have the fastest 3K PB as well, don't you? You're faster than Tommy, just?
What's your PB, Tom?
No, you tell me yours.
819.
Oh, shit.
8:20, I think.
Oh, I ran an 8:19 in training the other day. I'll just take that.
Oh, yeah. So did I. So did I. I just didn't upload it.
Yeah, actually, you got me there.
Actually, one new shoe I did get this month, and I've worn it 3 times, is the Saucony Endorphin Speed for some of the sessions.
Yeah.
And I've really enjoyed that shoe straight away from the get-go. Like, I actually, the day I got it, I took out my Pro, put up my left foot, took out my Speed, put up my right foot, went out and did some strides. And it was funny, walking in the two shoes, like the Saucony Endorphin Speed, they don't use carbon as the plate in the shoe, they use nylon. So it feels a bit more plush underfoot, so it feels a bit softer. So it feels like it absorbs more than the actual Pro when you hit the ground. But when you toe off, there's a distinct difference. Like, you leave the ground a bit earlier in the Pro because the carbon plate's a bit stiffer. So it feels like, you know, one leg was coming off the ground a bit early, but the other one was hitting the ground and staying on there for a bit longer where on the Speed. So I think if you're looking for a slightly plush shoe, more plush shoe to absorb, you'll like the Speed. If you're looking for a sort of a sharper shoe toeing off, you'll like the Pro. But they're both fantastic shoes. So the upper's a bit more industrial on the Speed, so it's probably a bit more of a training upper. But I reckon 90%, 95% of people, including myself, could race in the Speed comfortably and not feel too much of a difference, I reckon.
Could you do long runs in the Speed?
It still feels too quick for me for that, to be completely honest. I know you're looking for, like, really fun shoes for everything you do, but I could definitely do that. But I reckon I could run a fast 10K in the shoe. Like, I could probably run as well in that as I could in the, dare I say it, the next percent. So it does feel quite, you know, quite snappy. It's definitely more plush. I know, Tom, you talked a bit about the next percent being just better at absorbing shock and the Pro being better at sort of towing you off. And this is one of those shoes that sort of is probably a bit better on absorption, but probably doesn't tow you off quite as quick. You know, you can pick up the shoe and flex it through the midfoot a bit easier. And that, you can definitely feel that when you're doing a stride with one on one foot and one on the other. So, but so I recommend
just,
it.
Just run down the hill in your Speeds and then switch shoes with that when you're about to go uphill. That's
pretty well,
it, mate.
You wouldn't even know they look so similar.
Yeah. Actually, I've got black ones. So I got a tip off from Troy from Saucony, jumped online. I don't think they're even online anymore. They lasted about a day or two. So I'm not sure what Saucony did there. Like, a lot of people would jump into the Speed tomorrow, and I think it'd be an easy shoe to sell. In fact, I called it the easiest shoe to sell for racing, surely, but they just didn't make a lot of them by the looks of it. So
we got a lot coming in, though. A lot coming in next season, so it's all going to open up a bit.
Oh, well, you'll have easy sales then, I reckon, because I think that shoe, and it's pretty stable. Like, it's you've got a relatively good contact area. It's definitely not as stable as the Pro. The carbon just makes the shoes, you know, a bit stiffer. And I think, if anything, with this one Speed, the one change I would have, dare I say it, like, it's a bit softer, so therefore maybe have a touch more contact area, just flare it a bit more than the Pro. Yeah.
We've got a lot of ladies left. A lot of ladies' Speed, of course. But, yeah, it has been very well received.
Send them all to Run Crew. Send Gary. Yeah. Because I'm sure they'll love that shoe.
Plenty of girls would be into it, yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right.
Hey, guys, I have a good lesson of question here. It's from a patient of mine who listens to the show. Didn't know she listened to the show. It was very unassuming when she came in and said she loved the Shoe Geek show. A lady called Sarah. And she asked, if you could have one shoe, you're only allowed to have one shoe to do all your work in, so like sessions, long runs, easy jogs, can you narrow your runs down to one shoe? I know this would be your worst nightmare, Julian, but you had one shoe to wear for even current, like the current stock of shoes that are out, and also historical stock. So you can pick one from history and one from current stock. What shoe would you select and why?
Well, this is a good question. And this is a question faced by people who go traveling. Right, when you go away and you can only fit one shoe in and you've got to run easy runs and you might do a race, but you're going to do some workouts and some trail runs as well. So this happened to me 2013, went to America, had one shoe to take, were there for like 4 months or something, and traveling around, did two marathons during the time, so obviously needed a race shoe, and I took the Saucony Kinvara.
Yeah.
So pretty cushioned, 4 mil offset, racing weight, so a very light shoe, and pretty stable on trails, but just not the most durable option.
That's a good option.
Yeah, it was perfect. I'm so glad I picked that one. And I even updated while I was over there into a Saucony Kinvara.
What if while you were on holidays, you had a marathon?
Oh, I did. I had two marathons and I bought the Kinvara.
What if this was post 2017?
Okay. Yeah, so the
would your jogging shoe be the Vaporfly is my question.
Now that you both know the effect of the Vaporfly and you're both very good marathon runners, you both just pick the Vaporfly, wouldn't you?
But you got
That's what I'm getting at.
4 months.
Yeah, but like if you've got a race that you want to run well at, would you be able to, would you sacrifice not running in it?
I don't know. What if I went to the Grand Canyon and ran on the trails? You can't wear that for that.
Yeah, not
I would focus on the love of the run, not the time in the race.
I think that's a good point, because you said, say you have this shoe for a full year, you can't wear anything else. Like you're only running one or two marathons a year, but you're probably running, you know, 350 days of the year in this shoe. So you have to enjoy your running for the year.
When I think back on like that, using that, Julian, if like I remember when I did uni placement, I was gone for a month and I just wanted to take one pair of shoes, and I took I actually took the Lunar Races.
And
they were fantastic. I could actually, they weren't durable at all, and they were dead by the end of the trip. But I pretty much did all my volume in it and sessions and everything, and it just they felt great.
I've still got one pair left of them, to be honest.
You learn to get used to something, though, don't you? So if you've got no other choice, you go out for a jog, all of a sudden it just becomes the normal.
So that would be the shoe you'd pick, Tommy?
Yeah, Lunar Race is up there, and Epic React is, you know, one of my all-time faves. Just it's a lightweight, it's a good mix of not, you know, it's a lightweight, it's a very versatile shoe. You could do sessions in it and race in it, but if it was right now, like because I do a lot of road running anyway, I'm not running in the Grand Canyon or anything. I'd just be wearing Next Percent, because I'd want to. If I was trying to run a marathon PB, even if it's just a psychological factor, like I'd just be pissed off that I wouldn't have my my ZoomX under my foot. I can actually run relatively slow and feel stable and comfy in the Next Percent. What about you, mate?
What about, can I just throw one more in?
Yeah.
The ASICS Nova Blast. That would be a shoe you could run fast in, that you could jog in, you could put it through some trails. Like that's probably the option from my current stable of shoes, that's the one.
Yeah. The Nova Blast, probably not as, it's a bit higher stack. So I don't like it as much in the trails or on the dirt as I do. I mean, you guys just don't get along with the Infinity React, but I would pick that shoe currently because I've done sessions in it. I forgot it for 1K reps one night, and I was able to run about 308 to 312s in that quite comfortably. And my long runs, I do in it. I can tempo run in it. I can do strides and it feel fast. It's just, I prefer probably a slightly better lockdown heel counter in the shoe for faster running. But for jogging, I don't even notice that heel counter slopping around. But if, out of all of the shoes historically, I'd have picked. Do you guys ever wear the Zoom Elite, the fourth model, like there, back in the day? Had like a bit of a Duo Max.
Oh, Zoom Elite Four, I love that shoe.
Had a bit of a posting in it. Probably weighed maybe 270, 280. I did everything in that shoe. I could session, I could long run. So there was Zoom Air and the 4 foot as well. Like it was, and the outsole was relatively like waffled and grippy. Like that would be the one shoe I could have worn for everything. And feel like I could race pretty well in a marathon in it, because, you know, at the end of the day, it feels like it's got a bit more give at the end of the marathon, but light enough that it'll protect you. So currently the Infinity Run, the Infinity React, and probably historically the Zoom Elite 4 would be the shoe that I would pick.
Good question, Sarah.
Yeah. Well, I reckon that covers us all for the day. Yeah. You guys got much planned for the rest of the month? Any new shoes coming up? Or Julian, you must have new stock landing in the next couple of months, like, you know, some Air Victories coming my way.
There is the Air Zoom Victory that's going to hit, apparently. We're still waiting on, all Nike's October launches are going to come. There's going to be no new shoes there. I'm really hanging for the Vomero 15.
So fantastic.
That's January. Yep. So that one's I'm pretty stoked for. Then the New Balance 1080 V11 is going to hit in November.
Is there much change to that guy, or is it all pretty much the same?
it changes, the upper changes, and that's probably where that sort of struggled with a little bit. So looking forward to that. What else have we got coming? It's next year, but there's a shoe called the Ultra Timp that's coming out, and it's the Ultra Timp 3, I think, and it looks amazing. It looks like one of the best hybrid trail/road shoes that's out there, or that will hit the market. So I'm pretty into that.
Is it similar sort of, stack to like the Olympus, or is it a bit lower?
It's lower. It's going to be pretty nice. What else we got coming up? What else is looking really good?
You got any more performance shoes coming out from New Balance at all, or is it all pretty much stagnant for now until the next year comes out?
Well, yeah, we have the ASICS Magic Speed. That's going to be this is all next year. So April, that looks really,
That will get released similar. Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, obviously, briefly know that the meta race is going to have a high stack and a low stack version. And the high stack version was made famous at that marathon with Sarah Hall. So God knows what the foam will be. It looks a bit different to the other foams they've used historically. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they come there.
We haven't seen that yet. Also, the ASICS Hyperspeed comes out, I think it's December, and that's going to be a great shoe for the track. And so that sits below, but it's still really cushioned. So I reckon you're on there.
You're getting some of those?
Yeah, we're getting those. And I think that'll be it's not expensive either. I think it's like 170 or something. So a perfect shoe for someone who wants to not be spiked up.
I used to love that shoe. That was like back in like school days, Hyperspeed. It was all about that.
Yeah. Mm. Ryan Hall used to wear them for the marathon.
Yeah.
Ryan Hall. Okay, that's a great time to leave now.
Yeah, it is, guys. All right, you guys have a good week.
Okay.
You too.
All right. See ya.
Thanks. See you, guys. Bye.
All right, we're here, Nitta and I, with Danny Orr from New Balance Footwear. Good morning, Danny.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me.
Of course, mate. Thank you for coming on. Now, Danny, at the moment, can you give us your current job title with New Balance?
I'm the General Manager of Performance Running for New Balance.
Okay, wow. Is that the top dog?
I've definitely got a boss, so I wouldn't say I was the top dog, but in terms of like defining what we're doing from a performance running standpoint, setting the direction for the category, setting the direction for the shoes, working with our marketing teams in terms of what our storytelling needs to look like and our sales teams in terms of the best ways to sell them in. We are touching each of those different elements of it. I would say that the creation part is probably 70% of our role, and then 30% is all the other stuff that goes with it in terms of getting shoes into your stores and ultimately on consumers' feet.
Yeah, wow. Okay, cool. We'll go into your role a little more, but what other roles do you have within the footwear industry?
I feel like everybody, it's quite an insular industry, so we've all worked for other brands. I feel like my role at New Balance has been a couple of different things. I started with the brand about 8 years ago as the kind of running guy for Europe, so the product and merchandising manager for Europe. And then after doing that for a few years, I moved across to the US business. So I got transferred into the US team. And essentially what I did is I worked across all of international running, so things that were outside of New Balance North America. So really, really focused on what the needs were of the international business, largely driven by Europe from a pairage standpoint. But APAC and Australia, South Africa, obviously is dear to my own heart, being a South African. Mm-hmm. I did that for a couple of years, and then I moved on to the innovation team, which was really fun because I really got to focus almost 100% of my time on making running shoes better and looking at new different technologies or new upper technologies, bottom unit technologies that we could potentially bring into the brand to improve the consumer experience. The whole time, I also got to work across a couple of different categories, which was kind of fun, thinking about kind of what baseball, basketball, global football could look like as well. And then 12 months ago, I moved back onto the inline running team into the current role that I'm in.
Fantastic.
Is that where your passion lies, Danny? Are you a runner, or what's your background in sport?
You know, as a South African growing up, rugby and cricket were without a doubt the two things that I was more focused on than anything else. And running was always felt like a little bit of a chore, but it was a necessity to make sure that I was fit enough to do the sports that I wanted to do. And I feel like after high school and university, that definitely changed quite a lot as I got older. So I don't know. I don't know exactly where my count is right now, but I think I've run about 25 marathons, three or four ultra marathons. You know, in South Africa, we have two big ones that are a little Comrades. Bit of a rite of passage. So yeah. I've gone up and down in the Comrades and done the Two Oceans as well. And I definitely, for the longest time, I didn't consider myself a runner, but I definitely consider myself a runner today. And I'm incredibly passionate about the footwear, obviously, but just the space in general.
Now, I listened to a previous podcast. You mentioned that you had a bit of a background in lower limb biomechanics as well. Correct. Was that sort of something in education-wise you sort of led to lead to the innovation team? Or is that something that you did when you got onto the innovation team?
Yeah, so like it was like an extension of my degree course, right? So in South Africa, we talk about like your undergraduate and an honors degree. And in America, they talk about a master's degree. But after my undergraduate degree, I went and did an honors in that space after that.
Fantastic.
You know, it's interesting though, because in the role that I have, generally speaking, people are coming to it from either a trackster or a tech rep type role, or very varying degrees in terms of like backgrounds and things like that. A lot of people with marketing qualifications or business qualifications and things like that, generally all with a passion for running, but the general background is quite varied. And if anything, I'm a little unusual, in fact.
Yeah. So, Danny, when did you get to New Balance? Like, what year was it that you arrived?
You know, it's a funny story. In 2011/2012, you could buy tickets for the London Olympics, and I was living in London, and I bought tickets for every single track and field event that you could get through the lottery, and I didn't get any of those tickets, not one. And then I joined New Balance 6 months before the Olympic Games in 2012, and I got to go to every morning and every evening event. So it's funny, whenever anybody asks me that, I always go, remember when the Olympics was? Yeah. Remember what you did before?
And while we're on that, what was your highlight from that Olympics, track and field wise?
They've actually changed, unfortunately, because you know, part of my highlights would have been around some South African athletes that I definitely don't want to get into, but I would have said the other one was David Rudisha. I don't
800 final.
Just, you know, and it wasn't even the first 400, which was interesting. He got to about 500 and he literally just took off, and it was the most amazing thing. The whole stadium kind of jumped out of their seats because they recognized, not necessarily knowing track and field that well, but just recognized that it was a totally unique moment. And I feel like, I don't know if I know this 100% correctly, but I think everybody up to sixth would have won the gold at the previous Olympics. And he just dragged everybody along like a train.
Yeah.
And it was just this incredible thing to see. Being not English, I couldn't have called out like Super Saturday with Mo and Greg Rutherford and all those people doing well, because that wouldn't go down amongst my mates that well, that's for sure.
Now, Danny, when I got into the running industry, 2010, I started working in a running store. We used to stock New Balance because we had to have a shoe with width. Now, that was sort of that was the reason that we would have different New Balance models in the different categories. nowadays we have New Balance shoes because people really love running in them, and we carry them in multitude of widths. And that's probably the best example I've seen of a brand change its stripes and completely overhaul its range. Was that your doing? Were you the driver of this?
You know, I definitely wouldn't say that I was the initial driver. I hope I'm one of those people that have like picked up the baton and continued to run with it, as it were. And, you know, I really appreciate the comment. You know, when we started with this brand, so often we heard that, you know, we stock you because you're the guys that do widths. Yeah. We actually don't really care that much if the shoes are any good or not, but we care a lot about whether we can do widths through your brand. And it took a long time for us to be able to get to a point where we were viewed as a serious running brand that had widths versus a widths brand that did some running shoes. Yeah. As well. My boss is a guy called Tom Carlio, who is the VP of running for New Balance. And I feel like he needs the most credit in terms of having started a couple of years ahead of me and the team that he put together to really try and kind of right the ship, as it were, in terms of the type of product that we were making. And then he's empowered the rest of us to kind of get after it from there, and making sure that we're at the forefront of this industry and we keep modernizing and making the best shoes we possibly can.
Yeah, that's...
It's changed rapidly as well. When I was younger, we're going group long runs. New Balance was rarely seen on the long runs as well. But when we get together as a group now for about 20, 30 of us in the morning, our juniors between 16 and 20 years of age, there's more New Balance seen there than any other brand here right now, like the 880s and the 1080s, for example. So it's probably been the quickest moving brand I've seen outside of Nike in reshaping their shoes, and midsole technologies continuing to innovate as well. So it's been more apparent in the past 4 or 5 years that New Balance are moving quickly in the area of performance footwear. And just on that, like, I guess you've seen the industry evolve itself. Was there a shift from sort of, you know, more so trying to protect the athletes injury wise, and rather than that sort of focusing on, you know, performance and gravitating to, you know, footwear that essentially is revolving around improving the runner's performance as opposed to just, you know, trying to keep them more sustainable from injury?
Yeah, you know, thank you for that. And I definitely want to give credit to the Aussie team down there. You know, those guys are some of our most technical sales folks that we have anywhere in the world. And I think they've done a great job of educating your consumers as well as you have, obviously, in terms of our product. You know, I think one of the biggest shifts from where we've been is really trying to focus on athlete needs above everything else. I feel like the whole industry has been quite guilty of looking at one another just a little bit and building products based on perhaps where other brands were or what they might be doing that you felt was interesting. I feel like we've taken a real different route to it to try and get into the heart of not only our professional athletes, obviously, because they're really important, but we recognize that majority of our sales are going to not necessarily those professional people who are more often than not getting their shoes for free. But there's definitely been a relook at exactly how we wanted to attack each of those individual consumer groups and try to do the best that we possibly can to set the shoes up that we're creating for those people in a way that can be most meaningful for them, or just make them enjoy their running experience more, you know?
So when the shoe updates, just on a similar vein, Danny, say you've got the New Balance 1080 V10 that's turning into the V11. When you sort of go through a bit of a brief or you sit down and brainstorm, do you consider how can we help this shoe make someone more sustainable as a runner? Do you look at sort of reducing the injury rate that could be associated with running through a design change in the shoe? Or do you look at other factors like how can we make this shoe feel faster or softer or more stable? Is it model specific when you go into have that conversation?
You know, truthfully, we should probably go back one, because the 1080 V10 is really the one that's kind of set that shoe up on its most, you know, recent trajectory. And I feel like for the 1080V 6, 7, 8, and 9, we were fairly consistent in terms of what that product looked like. And we weren't gaining the market share we wanted, and we weren't gaining the share of runners that we wanted based on the consistency that we had. We also were skewing older than some of the other key competitors in that space. And one of the key things that we tried to do with the V10 is really blow up the formula, change the fit and feel and aesthetic of that shoe, as well as try and look at a younger consumer if we can do that. In the same period of time, we were working, and at this point I was on the innovation team, we were working on a new suite of materials that ultimately became Fresh Foam X. Mm-hmm. And we were of the opinion that these materials would further enhance the 1080 experience if we could get them into the shoe. And it kind of felt like this really revolutionary brief happening at a time where we had a new technology that we could implement at the same time. And those two things went really, really well together and got us to the point where we were with that shoe. I think what's important, though, is when you push a shoe on, like we did in that instance, it's important that at that point you also have some consistency. So if we pushed the V10 to where it was and then almost re-evolutionized re-revolutionized the V11, I feel like we would be showing that we didn't have a ton of faith or confidence in the decisions that we had ultimately made. So if you look at V10 to V11, they're a very consistent update in a very similar space. And if anything, it's as we get to 12 and 13, we're reevaluating again now exactly how we can continue to push that shoe on. But in terms of like the kind of key tenets, it was definitely to get softer and increase the rebound, to improve the overall comfort, to get a little bit younger. We weren't as concerned specifically with injured runners maybe as in that product as maybe you suggested in the question, but it was definitely around experience and newness and freshness in an area that's probably been a little bit stale for a little while.
Well, Danny, I can tell you that our younger runners wear the 1080 more than anything else. So you've nailed that in a sense if you're aiming for the younger market. But there were a couple of design features that were quite unique that made it look really cool as well, like the tapered away heel collar, the rocket 4-foot design, and obviously the Fresh Foam X as well. And tell us more about this Fresh Foam X. Obviously, it's the age of foams right now as well. What process goes in place? Is it real trial and error? Do you get foams sort of offered to you to trial out as a company at New Balance, or do you go and search it out, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think, you know, to your point, and I've said this a few times, so if you've heard it already, I apologize, but I do feel like a little bit like every chemist in Asia, their brains have exploded based on exactly where we are right now and how hard we're pushing. You know, we've always been in a situation, or not always, but traditionally we've been in a situation where somewhere between a 0.18 and a 0.25 SG was kind of where all the foams were. And yeah, they were all kind of at a 55 hardness. That was the norm, maybe 53 to 55. You know, we're working in a span right now that's all the way down to 30. We've got some 0.12 SGs. We've got supercritical foams versus EVA foams. And it really is this world that is probably faster changing in footwear than anything else right now. In terms of how we go about it, you know, we obviously have vendors that we are working with, that we are briefing, or that we are actively seeking out that can bring the different things that we're looking for. We also, though, almost with that notion of the chemist brains being blown, we are seeing more and more people coming our way as well, with different ways of looking at it, different opportunities that we could potentially get behind if we wanted to do that. In terms of Fresh Foam X, I think one of the things that's super interesting is that it comes from the same family as majority of the fuel cell foams as well, just at slightly different densities. The ask from our side is that we wanted to take the rebound up just across the board, fuel cell more so than Fresh Foam, but we wanted to take the rebound up across the board. And I think the consumer can't always articulate what exactly has changed in the shoes so much. And I feel like we hear about softness. And in terms of the 1080, the softness has come down. But the bigger change has probably been that the energy return's gone up. And I think that's the thing that they can't quite articulate. But I think it's probably
the biggest difference maker. The other thing that was really interesting, because we don't obviously just use one compound here, because if you're making a basketball shoe or a baseball shoe, those midsoles are much harder than running, but yeah. they still are within the fresh foam family, right? So we have multiple different foams that exist within the space. And I think the one thing that was really interesting with fresh foam X almost above everything else is that even if we varied the hardness, we didn't lose out on the rebound. So generally the way rebound works is if you make the foams denser, so heavier, and you bring the softness down, you often would then get the most rebound. And in terms of the fresh foam shoes, as well as the fuel cell shoes, the densities are consistent. We can vary the hardnesses and still get the same rebound. And we had never seen that before.
Yeah, fantastic.
Danny, how do you balance, when you go softer with your foams, how do you balance the stability component of the shoe? Because we've seen, especially with shoes maybe like the Ultra Boost from Adidas, where the shoes are quite soft, but they feel very unstable. How do you compromise in that feature, as well as durability when the foams get softer?
Yeah, it's probably those two things are the two biggest challenges that you've got to solve for, right? I think if we like tackle the first one around stability, we're more often than not looking at geometries and then just the underfoot shape of those midsoles, affecting the nets and the bottom units to ensure that we're accounting for some of the changes that we're making in terms of the softness. Another key component is often rubber placement too. So we feel like the additional density and hardness that you get in a rubber, provided it's in the right places, you can actually do quite a lot to also help offset some of the softness with that. It's also a key component in the durability side of it. The one comment I'd make on the durability piece is that it hasn't been a need that we've had to solve for quite as much as the stability part of it, because we haven't changed the densities excessively. So even though the hardnesses have changed by quite a lot, the densities have almost remained this similar, not the same, but similar, which means that the overall guts of the foam and how long you should get out of it haven't changed drastically. And I know shoes probably are trending towards being less durable now than they've probably been trending to being less durable over the last 10 years. And maybe over the last 2 to 3 years, they've become even maybe a little bit less durable. We haven't seen a massive drop off though in terms of the foam's durability. When you compare that to making sure that you're solving for the stability options or stability concerns, should I say?
And in a sense where like running related injury research is quite vague, do you follow the research for that sort of stuff to be able to implement it into your running shoes? Or is it more trial and error from the consumer and feedback where you start to, I guess, alter the geometry of the shoe and alter the surface contact area of the outsole, et cetera, and midsole to make things more stable? Or do you have a biomechanics team in there where you're sort of looking for changes within shoe from the change that you make mechanically on the shoe as well?
Yeah, you know, the thing about research is, generally speaking, research is done to solve a problem. And once you've solved that problem, it almost doesn't go any further. So to your point, the research out there is very fragmented in relation to what you might be trying to solve for. 100% we are doing literature reviews whenever we start something new to see what's out there that we can learn from and use as kind of building blocks for where we want to go. So that is 100% part of the process. We have our own team, and generally speaking, because what we are potentially trying to solve for doesn't line up exactly with the literature that's out there, we need to try and solve for that in a lot of instances ourselves, which is very hard to do on like an inline timeline where you're going from V1 to V2 to V3. So it's often something that gets taken away by an innovation team to try and understand, and those briefs are created. And then more than anything else, we really, really do like to allow the data to drive those decisions that are being made over and above what we may have done previously or what someone's own kind of 20 years in the industry kind of filter would provide on something like that, and really try and take as many of the opinions out of it as you possibly can. And do things that are more data driven, if and when you possibly can, you know.
Fantastic.
Maybe a different style question, Danny. What are the when you look at it in the industry now, what are the shoes that are exciting you the most?
You know, it's a great question, right? Because I think it's for me, it's less about like the individual models, and it's more about probably models within their categories. Because I think you often have this conversation about which is the best shoes or which are the most exciting shoes. And I often like to go back to the categories and say, within each of these categories, which ones do I think are the best shoes and which ones do I think are changing the game more than anything else right now. I know you guys were talking about track spikes a few weeks ago, but we are seeing such phenomenal results with our track spikes right now that it's definitely a part of the market. Maybe it's a part of the market where innovation has been sorely lacking for a long time, and track spikes have been around. Do they fit and do they have traction? And after that, almost no one's cared about them.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's definitely something where we're seeing a lot of new stuff come into this and some really exciting results. I think the super shoe world is really interesting for me. And I actually think the stability world is really interesting right now, just in terms of people trying to bring new innovations into that space, trying to attack some of those older problems in more unique ways. And I feel like those are three of the areas that for me right now would probably be standing above other parts of the overall running shoe range, as it were.
Julian, I can tell you my favorite shoe in the past 2 years where I've unwrapped a box. I was lucky enough maybe about a year and a half ago to get onto Running Warehouse and sneak a 5280. Now, a lot of Australian market haven't seen a New Balance 5280. They didn't sell them, I guess, in mass here. And they were built for the road mile. And I'm sure that was the first shoe that you put into the fuel cell, but it was almost like a track spike without spikes built for the road mile. And it didn't even need spikes. It had such a good fragmented outsole, which went onto your RC Elite, very similar. And I wore it on the track a few times last year, and it's the first time I thought, oh, I wish I had this shoe when I was like 18 to 20, when I had sore calves all the time from running track, because the first time I had a lightweight shoe, I could run on the track with like a spike. And I reckon before the Dragonfly from Nike was released, it was the first to try and create a really low profile track spike with these super foams. And can you tell us a bit more how that came about, the 5280?
Yeah. Talk about a labor of love in the 5280. You know, the that I would say from my own standpoint has probably been one of the most intense, one of the most frustrating, and probably ultimately the most rewarding shoe projects that I've ever worked on personally. And I know that what we ended up delivering was the best possible solution we possibly could for those shorter distance races. And the results that have come from that have been, yeah, just fantastic in terms of the athlete times and just the general consumers that have really, really loved that shoe. You know, I feel like we were in a period where just starting to talk about improving athlete performance through footwear, which, you know, obviously another brand kind of kicked off that conversation. And, you know, we sat around as a team and went, okay, if we wanted to look at what type of athletes we would like to try and help the most, and if anything, build upon that story, within our brand, we had a suite of middle distance athletes that were probably the strongest part of our business. Through our partnerships with the New York as well as London Marathon, we own two of the largest road mile competitions in the world. And it really felt like there was a good synergy between athlete need and you know, kind of a sports marketing type approach that would make sense for it. And then the other thing we looked at is really trying to understand benefits and where the benefits were going in terms of a road marathon solution, and whether we would be needing to provide different benefits in the type of solution that became a 5280. So if we looked at economy or efficiency as being your marathon benefit, immediately what we identified is that economy and efficiency is nice in a mile, because if anything, if you've got a couple of percent at the end of the race, chances are it's going to help your sprint finish. But ultimately, the notion of improved power or kind of aerobic, anaerobic type conversation definitely became a much more prevalent need to potentially solve for. So I felt like we attacked the performance enhancement type conversation in a very much different way, in which we were really looking to see if we could enhance not only that economy, but also the ultimately that power driver for the last, I don't know, call it 200 yards, right? Where ultimately those races are won and lost versus a marathon, where it's probably won and lost more over the 26.2 miles.
Danny, just touching on the shoes in your range, the TC, the RC, and the 5280, they all feature a pretty prominent lateral flare to the design. Can you tell us a little about that lateral flare and why it's on there?
I was waiting for this one because I heard it in one of the other podcasts that I listened to a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, what we identified with the 5280, with Jenny Simpson being the primary athlete and then building in and around that, Jenny's proposition wasn't necessarily dramatically different to everybody else, but probably more extreme than everybody else in that use case. And one of the key things with that shoe was really trying to work on the transition. So I don't know if it was Julian who said he had one, but I don't know if you've ever tried to flex it and bend it versus one of the Nike products or one of the Saucony products today. If you hold a 5280 and you try and bend it longitudinally, it's very stiff. But if you try and twist it, it's very, very flexible. Whereas the other shoes, and certainly a TC and a RC Elite, wouldn't be the same way. And one of the reasons for that is we were really trying to improve the transition the whole time. One of the ways to do that was by capturing the landing phase, particularly for Jenny, a little bit earlier and trying to transition her through her gait cycle a little bit quicker with the flexible plate that then stiffened her toe off to provide her that propulsion benefit that I was talking about. On the other shoes, guys, truthfully, it's a design element. So yeah. I don't know exactly who was on the podcast earlier suggesting that the wing is making them potentially pronate more. Right now, my suggestion would be that because you're probably abducted, maybe a little bit abducted, generally when your foot is loaded, you're seeing more of the lateral foam on the outside of the shoe, which gives you the impression that the shoe is pronated versus the shoe being actually more pronated than it might be in another shoe. If you were talking about the 5280, I would agree with the conversation. I think when we look at an RC Elite and we look at a TC, in almost every use case, the consumer is going to miss that wing. It's too far out of their traditional landing zones to actually hit it. You might do in a 5280, but I don't think you would be doing that in an RC Elite and a TC. And I actually think it's just a visual that's unusual for you, versus the fact that the foot is actually in a more compromised position.
I tend to agree with that as well. Like, I reckon even when you're running faster, you probably form more of a like a hip abduction or various angles. So the actual 5280 having the flare probably accommodates it nicely. But I don't really notice it much when I run in the RC Elite. I noticed a bit more in the TC with a slightly firmer outsole. I think maybe with a bit more contact area of the outsole, I could feel it a bit more. But more so walking. As soon as I started running, it sort of disappeared, the outside, that feeling, the lateral part of the shoe. So it was an interesting try, whether it was designed to try and put you back through the high gear through your big toe, or whether it was a durability thing. I was interested to see what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, and that is 100% what it was driven on from a 5280 standpoint. And then in the other two shoes, it's largely just a design visual that's been building off what we did with the 5280, and making sure that the line felt cohesive and that we had a similar story to tell. But it really is a design detail versus a functional detail in that instance. But for the 5280, it was definitely more function driven.
Cool.
Hey, Danny, do you have some sort of measurement of stiffness with your shoes? Like when you say you're creating or you're working on the 880, and someone's pushed the boundaries in terms of flex grooves. Do you have some sort of measurement where you go, oh, no, we've passed the threshold here. It's become too flexible for the type of training shoe that it is?
And when you say flexibility, you're talking about the flexor, like the ability for the shoe to bend versus the material stiffness, right?
Yes, yes. Basically, like the new Balance Rebel, that's the version 2, it's extremely flexible. I think that's the one that I'm remembering seeing a sample of, where we could turn the shoe on itself backwards, if you know what I mean. You could almost
tell me you got to try it on and you loved it.
I'm 11 and a half. I haven't tried it on. Yeah.
Well, I hope we've got one coming for you, because the only way I'm gonna describe the Rebel V2 is that the shoe is wild.
I don't think Julian's wearing any flexible shoes for the next couple of weeks from the line I've seen him wearing recently.
Well, yeah, that's true too. I think of the two shoes that we've got, two new shoes we've got coming for the front end of next year, the Rebel's going to be the one I'm most excited about, and I think the More V3 is probably the second one. But you know, the to answer the initial question is yes, 100%. We have various different mechanical setups within our sports research lab that are measuring different flexibilities, not only the amount of flexes you might do, but the actual amount of flexibility that each shoe would have. So we have very, very specific measurements across all of our shoes for that level of detail. We also have an incredibly robust fit and wear test program in which we have every round of those shoes that ultimately you get to see have been through significant stages in terms of different fit and wear. We're looking at feedback, we're looking at wear, we're looking at overall durability, we're taking people's commentary, and we're trying to marry up the mechanical systems in which we're seeing some data, and then looking at some of the just general wear and overall fit and feel feedback of the shoes, and pairing those two things together to ultimately try and make our decisions. The reason I love the Rebel V2 so much is that we've taken the same foam that's in an RC Elite and we haven't put a plate in it. And that's what makes the shoe really, really wild and really unique in the market. I think the opportunity for this shoe is going to be broader than the Rebel V1 because I feel like it's a little bit more accommodating. But I feel like in terms of true underfoot experience, this is going to be a standalone product in the market on the timeline that it's in. And without a doubt, the shoe has been fantastic for people that want to run fast in it. But I think there's something about just the overall setup and the foam that makes it really, really work on kind of slow and easy days as well. So it's this interesting balance in which the foam almost in a sense firms up and becomes a much more performance solution when you're going faster, but is really nice and soft and compliable when you're not. I'm not saying it's going to be for everybody, but I do think that the people that see it and love it and can try it are really going to get behind this Rebel V2.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's a because you're talking to a retailer right now, Danny, when we see a shoe like this come in and the sales rep sort of passes it over and says, this is the new Rebel, we have to justify it being in the range, and we have to think about the athlete who it's for and where it sits on the wall. And if there's no sort of category that it already sits in, then we all, like, maybe it's a little default, but we try to find a spot for it to sit in. And if we start comparing it to something like, if say the customer walks in and says, I want a fast shoe, well, the RC Elite's going to be probably more appropriate than the Rebel. And if they say, I want an easy running shoe, then maybe we can look at something like, well, the 880, which is a more stable, safer shoe. So it when you start blurring the lines, it makes it difficult for us, by the way.
But it makes it exciting for me. Like even the first Rebel was sort of like standalone-y, sort of think it was a performance shoe, but I loved it for, say, heel rep, but I loved it because it was relatively soft underfoot. But I don't mind a compliant shoe either. It's just that we don't often see it in the market sold for most of the population. Like if you say it's going to be a standalone shoe, well, that's innovation, isn't it? But obviously the key is to try and get that consumer to work out that's a shoe that is standalone.
Yeah, and you know what? I totally get that. I mean, I worked in retail at one point as well. So I know exactly like where you're coming from. What I would say is this, is it's not something that we've created to think that it would just stand on its own. the goal is that it really does work in partnership with the RC Elite. I feel like we've seen a gap in the market where people are going from an 880 to an RC Elite, and the transition between those two things, or the jump between those two things, is often too much. So we've really thought about that consumer who really should be running in an RC Elite, but doesn't want to wear it every day, doesn't want to wear carbon fiber every day, and the shoe's too much money for him to be able to getting new ones all the time. Is there a product that can complement that one? So his transition throughout the week of whether it be normal runs, long runs, tempo runs, whatever that might be, the thought process was that those two things would work really, really well together. And we felt like the gap was that the other brands might not have had as good an equivalent to us as that one. While I appreciate that lining things up in terms of the categories works well in a retail environment, I think one of our challenges as well as we're trying to broaden our range and think about different experiences for consumers is trying to identify white space. And I feel like if you can identify the right type of white space, ultimately, hopefully one day that'll become a category or something that can almost sit on its own. So I feel like while it might not fit perfectly today, I think the thought process in terms of how it would combine with an RC Elite, as well as what we think the opportunity might be more long term, is kind of the way that we thought about it, you know?
Yeah. And so just on the flexibility component to the shoe, we often see those that go from a rigid shoe to a very flexible shoe, it might be quite a drastic change in load. Do you sort of see flexibility in a shoe, or like extreme flexibility, as a potential risk factor for a runner?
I think it can be. I think it can be if it's not for the right type of runner. And I think it can be if it's a drastic change from kind of where you've been, right? I think we probably have a flexibility level that would be a little bit more traditional. And maybe we talk about an 880 in that instance. And then we have a shoe that's really not flexible in one of these shoes with carbon fiber. And I feel like the consumers had to learn how to perhaps run in that product. We've heard things around some muscle tightness, definitely some quad and calf tightness, as people have started to really understand what this type of footwear should be for them and how their bodies have reacted to it. And I feel like on the opposite side of the spectrum, you might put the Rebel. And again, I feel like there's probably a little bit of a learning curve for that person who wants to use that shoe. But ultimately, I do think that those two juxtapositions working together in terms of the Rebel and a shoe like the RC Elite can lead to a really nice balance in terms of where they want to get to from a training standpoint.
Yeah, cool.
And we've mentioned the RC Elite. So for the listeners out there, this is New Balance's performance road shoe, the super shoe, so to speak, as well. This has obviously been a relatively long time in the making, this RC Elite, but I've found this shoe to be one of my favorite training shoes. The outsole is very unique compared to other super shoes. It's the only one that can really, really grip well when it's super wet and it's nice on the track. But tell us about how you got to the RC Elite, because it would have been a process, no doubt. And right now we see this on our Elite Marathon. So those who, you know, listen to the other Inside Running podcast, Ellie, you understand Ellie, this is her racing shoe on the road. And so it's become quite popular here now. It's been released, I think, 4 weeks ago, wasn't it, Julian?
I can't remember. It was only lasted a couple of minutes in the summer. They came in, we packed them up, they left, and that was that.
and we're struggling to make more, so I'll apologize for that in advance.
Okay.
We want to make sure that we get the product as right as we can, you know, from the outset. And I think we learned a ton with the 5280, and then we really wanted to transition that to the marathon as quickly as we could. I feel like what we learned immediately is that some of the materials that made the 5280 work didn't necessarily lead to the best portable marathon racing shoe as we could possibly make. And we needed to go out and develop new materials as well as capture the new level of data that we wanted to make sure that we got that RC Elite exactly where it was. The transition into a training version before getting to the true racing version lined up much better with what we knew, the types of materials that we had, as well as an area in the market that we felt like was potentially untapped with all the racing shoes that existed already. So it was a little bit of a transition in terms of what we had available, again, where we thought the opportunity was, knowing that you only have one chance to make a really good first impression, and taking the time that was necessarily in terms of the data capture and the overall materials that we needed to get to the RC Elite V1 and make sure it was our best possible shot, you know, first time out the gate, as it were.
And where do you think the limitations for the RC1 is? What will we see change in future models, do you think, of the RC?
Well, you know, World Athletics came in, right, and they've put some guidelines and some guardrails up that make it difficult, you know, to maybe deviate too far, and in the same breath, give you an opportunity to push on from where you were before. So in relation to the RC Elite for us, the centerline height didn't go all the way up to the maximum in terms of what World Athletics were allowing. What we've heard consistently from our sports research lab is this midsole material is so good, we just need to use more of it, and we need to use more of it, and we need to use more of it. And I feel like our biggest change was thinking about whether maximizing that height, adding maybe a subtle amount of additional weight to the shoe by doing that would ultimately provide a better performance.
Yeah.
So that was our biggest conversation in that. And ultimately, that's what we've done. The biggest change between RC Elite V1 and RC Elite V2 is that we're getting 5% additional energy return out of that midsole. And essentially, that is giving us an improved economy benefit on the end of that. So we've added more foam. We've added a touch more weight, which ultimately could negatively affect performance. But because of the additional rebound we're getting, even adding the additional weight is ultimately giving us a better athletic performance at the end of the day. And that's the biggest change with that shoe. And I think, you know, again, not to reference other brands, but I think we've also seen other things come into the brand that started this that have meant heavier shoes, but ultimately better performance as well.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And with World Athletics, you mentioned briefly about how the footwear roles have changed, and it's become even more apparent here on the track events, for example, with a maximum stack height of 25 mils being the guideline for sort of 800 metres plus. Will we see some sort of more beefed up fuel cell spikes come out in the near future for the track, so similar to the 5280 for the consumer to wear come the summer events?
Yeah, so we've had three spikes in the market already. Two of them that we've sold and one of them that we haven't. One focused on middle distance events and one focused on longer distance events. And you know, it's interesting in that our most consistent data right now is actually in our track spikes. So I think you've heard a lot of people talk about like performance enhancement in footwear, and some people benefit more and some people benefit less. And we've definitely seen that. What we have seen in the track spike world, though, is the variance in that benefit has reduced greatly. And that, I think, is because of the consistent surface and also obviously the consistent shape that people are running around in that environment that just lends to more consistency. And I think it was in one of your earlier podcasts questioning, you know, performance enhancement and how much could you actually get out of that spike. We are seeing a significant improvement in the two spikes that we brought to market over what we would have done traditionally. It's through the foam, and we have a bottom loaded carbon fiber plate that has the traction details as well in the midsole of the, or in the bottom of the shoe, that has led to a lot of additional stiffness. And those are the things that we think are providing that enhancement. The first athletes to wear them were in the World Champs last year. Every single one of them ran a PB, which was very interesting, or PR, which was very interesting. I think the other thing we got from that was that all of them suggested that their ability to recover was so much better than where it had been before. People, you know, like someone like Jenny or Emma, who ended up winning a silver medal, finished their prelims and felt like they had not even been for a run yet. And when they compared that to how they would have been in an MD-800 or an LD-5000, just in general, their ability to recover was drastic. And we kind of went from those three three athletes, including Ellie Puria at the World Champs, and have brought that into our mainstream athlete group in 2020. And although we haven't had a ton of racing, every athlete in those products right now has run a PR in them. So whether we be talking about, you know, Jake Whiteman and any of these guys in Europe that have been, you know, running so much more frequently than anywhere else in the world, we are more confident in our results for the track spikes right now almost than anything else, which is a fun place to be.
That's exciting.
Now, this question comes in from Chris White. Danny, you're big 6'4" mate from Australia. He's interested in, do you consider the extrapolating of a shoe as it gets into those very big sizes? For instance, he's a size 14, and he was wondering if the midsole stack height changes, and does the plate change shape in a super shoe, or does the depth of where it sits change as well within the shoe?
Two of the three.
Okay.
So the midsole thickness changes, yep. And the height of the plate where it sits in the shoe changes based on the size going up. Right now we are grading our plates in a similar shape, but there's a stiffness variance across that, but we're not ultimately changing the plate shape. We are changing the position that it sits within the shoe, and we are changing the centerline height of that midsole as we get bigger.
Excellent. Thanks. Now, you've probably been involved in some projects that haven't gone as successfully as what we're seeing on the market right now. What are some sort of concepts that have flopped? Or what's a shoe that you've been part of that came in the market and did not last a long time?
How long have you got? we're obviously in certain areas really, you know, trying out different things and sometimes testing the market and failing. I think maybe a most recent one that maybe you know, did you guys stock the Rubix? Do you know what the Rubix is?
Oh, yes. We didn't stock it, but it was shown to us.
Yeah, so I think that would be an example. And again, I was part of that project from the beginning. And it was one of those conversations where we were trying to understand if we could provide a new kind of innovative stability solution. And we were looking at the market saying, well, what it seems like the market is doing is it's providing solutions that sit almost exclusively on the side of the foot in the form of like rails that would sit on the side of the shoe to provide a stability solution. We didn't like that as an idea. We turned around and went, well, what if we actually looked directly underneath the foot for our stability solution and whether we could create almost a guidance solution versus two different sidewalls on the side of the shoe. And we got fantastic results from the Rubix just in terms of the overall stability elements that we got out of that and the stability results that we got out of it. And definitely the plan was to start with this very unique and kind of arresting visual and then move that on to something that would be a little bit more palatable maybe and a little bit more consistent with the rest of the market from a visual standpoint. And I think ultimately what we did is we took too big a swing at that first visual, which made the shoe polarizing. And in my mind, I was like, guys, have a look at how cool this is. Look inside it, realize what we've done with this ramps concept directly underneath the foot. And I was thinking we would be able to educate people that way. But ultimately wearability remains really important. And I probably need to take most of the blame for the fact that everyone was pushing to make it a little bit less extreme. Well, not everybody, but a good group of people were pushing to make it a little bit less extreme. And maybe if we had done that, we would have been in a more successful position with that shoe today.
Great. Yeah, that was a good... Sometimes it can be a little... there's a breakdown of communication between what you're looking at and trying to achieve and what and how it gets presented to us in the market as well. Across the board. So it would be actually really interesting to hear these stories when we're shown a shoe. Same with the Rebel as well. I'm not sure whether that's something that you can sort of pass down the chain as well as you sort of are on a podcast right now, but just to hear.
You know what's interesting is I know I've got some time with the Australian sales guys coming up as part of their sales meeting presentations for the back end of 2021. One thing that these slightly, or maybe not slightly, these weird times have done for us is it's allowed us actually to get closer to the teams that exist around the world, because we definitely do find that there's a bit of broken telephone in terms of what we were originally intending and what can often come out in the market. And I think we're getting better, and we, through our marketing and through our storytelling and through the assets we create, we need to be better at making sure that our sales teams understand exactly what the product teams were envisioning. But, you know, one thing that has helped is Skype or Teams or any of these tools. I feel like in a lot of instances, we're actually more in touch with our teams that are in far-flung parts of the world than we would have been, because previously we would have relied more on actually being there and not use the technology at our disposal to be able to do that. I've been to one New Balance Australia sales meeting. That was it. I'm trying to think about when that was right now. It was probably back in kind of 2015 type time. So it's probably 5 years since I've been in Australia. And, you know, I feel like just using some of this technology will give a bit more insight into what we're doing than having people come out to Australia every 5 years. You know what I mean?
Well, it was probably a month ago, maybe. Our cricket, you'll love this, our cricketing sales rep, Big Murray, loves his cricket. He came to us and said, hey, we're going to be chatting with the product guys in a week. Send through your questions. What would you like to know? And that was, I thought that was a real breakthrough. We've never had that with any brand before, where we can go, hey, can you ask about this? Or can you tell us what the difference is between these? What's the difference between Fresh Foam X and Fresh Foam? And that, I thought that was revolutionary.
Yeah, you know, I've been lucky enough to go to a lot of our sales meetings around the world. Like what we once tried to do as well in certain markets is actually get the key, like, influential accounts to actually come to the meeting and sit in the same room as the sales guys and kind of learn at exactly the same time as they were learning in terms of what some of the new products were doing. And I feel like that's also another way of doing something similar to what you were suggesting, and just giving people more access in general. Because we would rather you guys knew more. The better that you could ultimately sell our products onto consumers, and the better our teams could sell them onto you, it's kind of a win-win, you know. So, you know, anything like that we can do to try and be better in terms of making sure that everyone's got the information that they need, we would be 100% aligned with that.
Fantastic. And the question that you probably get relatively often is, like, we're at this nice, exciting phase of the super shoes and building great technology to improve performance, or at least accommodate performance. What do you foresee in the future, like 10 years down the track? Have we hit a plateau in terms of, you know, product and technology, or is there still really exciting things happening in the near future that we can all, you know, be on edge of our chair for?
I have no doubt that in the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see as much innovation and newness and excitement in the running shoe world as we've probably seen in the last 2 to 3 years. I don't see anything in the short term stopping, but I think everything's cyclical, right? And we're going to get to a point where we've exhausted the innovations that we have currently coming into the shoes. There's going to be a time of reassessment, I think, to a little bit. Certainly from a true innovation standpoint, we are looking at what other industries are doing and what other spaces are doing to often lead our thinking and our material choices and some of those things. So I feel like there, no doubt, there's always going to be an influx of new things coming, and we'll pick up on the innovation train again. I feel like we right now are planning in and around 3 to 5 years from now, and I know how full our pipeline is to the 3 year kind of point. And then I think we'll see what else comes to fruition and what else might be out there that we might want to latch into and continue pushing ourselves forward. But I do think it's natural that we'll have peaks and some valleys and some slight troughs as we continue to track upward, as it were.
Now, Danny, you mentioned that before we started, you've listened to a couple of our older Shoe Geek podcasts, in that you took some issue and had some disagreements with us. So let's talk about them.
Where to start, right? funny because I was listening to them on a run, truthfully, and I was going, I need to remember that one. I need to remember that one. And I came back, or not just one run, multiple runs. And I came back, and I don't have the list in front of me, but I started kind of writing things down, as it were. I think one that I wanted to call out was the track spike piece, I think, and you know, some of the comments around, again, a competitor track spike that guys were trying, and letting you know that I feel like we've got something that is 100% competitive and almost as exciting, and let you know as well, because I feel like there were questions around knowing that a road shoe with 40 mils could do so much, wondering whether a track spike maybe couldn't do quite as much, and just suggesting to you guys that we are seeing fantastic results in that space as well. I think another one that was interesting to hear was talking about like product extensions, right? And you were talking about more traditional running shoes as maybe being more performance running shoes, and then looking at like a lighter version of a competitor shoe that's ultimately an extension on their range that they're trying to think about a different consumer for, and maybe thinking about that in less of a performance way. And I almost, my question to you was going to be a little bit about trying to understand some of that. And then Julian, the last one was, you made a comment about wanting to be in the more, so I was hoping I could sell you on the more versus the current Stinson that you're in.
Well, let me tell you, Danny, I've been through some mores, and the outer sole's a little soft for me.
Well, the more sold out here in Adelaide. Like, it's one of those shoes we put in. So for people that don't know, the New Balance more is like a stiff high stack shoe, and you know, it almost paints the picture of what looks like a Hoka, and good for people with big toe arthritis, midfoot arthritis, but they're sold out here. They are like hard to come by, but the first model was definitely stiffer than the second model, that's for sure.
And Nitta, we still have a lot in, but we put, like, we're a big fan of the shoe. We're putting monthly drops on, and we've got a contract for that shoe. That's how much that we have faith in it. And like, we just have that customer now that's one of our, well, that'd be in our top three sort of customers that come through, someone requiring that type of shoe.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think that's good to hear, you know, the comment about outsole kind of softness. You know, the outsole is obviously EVA in the version one and version two as well. So I feel like that's probably where some of the softness comments will come from. What I would say is that we feel like we haven't delivered one as good as the V3. And I know every brand says, well, wait for the next one. It's going to be the best one. But we've seen a massive increase in terms of the sell-in of the V3. Our results for the V3 in terms of what's going on in our sports research lab, as well as our wear testing, are better than we've seen for the V1 and the V2. I personally have not really run in that type of product and not gone on with it. But I did a lot in the V3, and I feel like there's a lot in that even for me as a runner, and maybe a broader spectrum of runners, are going to like about that shoe. You know, it's no longer an EVA outsole, it's rubber now. We've made the midsole a little softer. It's ZoomX. It's Fresh Foam X with rubber versus EVA. And the shoe's also got more of a rocker. So I think overall that the transition in that instance is going to be better too.
Oh, very good.
Very good. I like that. Yeah. And the New Balance More Trail, I've been running in that as well. That I've just seen some images actually for the next version. That gets pretty funky.
Yeah, that was a cool one, right? I feel like often the briefs on that type of shoe are often like wide open plains and very manicured kind of trails, or very like simple trails, because they're that type of product. And the challenge to the design team is there's a famous South African ultra trail race called the Otter Trail, which was part of a series that went on over the last few years in terms of an outdoor trail racing type series. And it has some of the most varied terrain that you can imagine. There's some super technical rocky areas. There's obviously some more easier trail areas. You're running through water, you're going over things and under things, and it's almost like an adventure race meets a trail race. And one of the goals on the brief was to see if we could make that shoe work as well in a really technical, rocky, uneven trail environment as it would work in where that type of shoe is traditionally done well in a more groomed trail environment. And I feel like through some additional flexibility, through some of that toe spring comment like that I've mentioned, I feel like we're in a really nice space in terms of the ability to be able to use that shoe in more varied a terrain than maybe you would have been able to do with the V1.
Okay, cool.
I'll make sure that the bookings are high.
There you go.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for giving your time up today.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, thank you. Thanks very much for having me. It's always good to sit around with people that are clearly passionate about footwear and the running space and, you know, wanting to find the best possible solutions for their consumers. So I'm glad if I helped at all, I hope I did. But it was just fun sitting around talking about shoes anyway.
There'll always be shoe geeks out there, definitely.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well done. Thanks heaps for that, Danny, and thanks for all the work that you've done to, you know, make a brand relatively, you know, I guess, jump out, be super exciting in the past decade.
Yeah, thank you. We have an incredibly talented team of designers and developers that are working on products every day. So I'm just one person in this whole thing, and they deserve equally as much credit. And I feel like we have probably the best team in the industry sitting back in Boston, you know, working on these shoes for you. And it's good that you guys are enjoying what they've become as much as we've enjoyed creating them, you know.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Okay. Thanks, Danny.
Thanks, cheers, guys.
Bye.
Cheers, then. Bye.
To the hope that all the suffering was so.